Welcome to episode 55 of the Vancouver Tech Podcast. Hello, my name is Drew Ogrizek.
And I'm Alex Moxon. Hi.
Hi. So how was your week, Alex?
I had a pretty busy week. Lots of learning, a bunch of coding progress, which is awesome. And some pair programming with the guys over at AdaptTech. So yeah, great week.
Sounds pretty cool. So a bunch of coding, a bunch of pair programming, a bunch of learning. What kind of stuff? Tell us a bit about it.
What kind of stuff?
Yeah.
Good question. Learning. Apparently, I've learned a lot. Yeah. No. So setting up some event sourcing systems or event sourced systems, mm-hmm. writing some tests around that, some Carta programming, I think it's called. Mm-hmm. Anyway, and I updated my blog. But really just spending time with various different things. I'll be looking into React soon, which will be good. Mm-hmm. The work that we did was in Node, mm-hmm. so Node.js, and just getting comfortable with all the different things like terminal and all the procedures and all that kind of stuff, and proper protocols and how to indent your code and how to do things right.
Very cool. So is that in line with what you were blogging about as well?
It was.
Blog about things you were learning?
Yeah.
That sounds pretty cool. It sounds like a good way to kind of keep up on it. Mm-hmm. It also sounds like some really cool stuff to be jumping into. So you said something about event storming or event sourcing rather mm-hmm. than getting that set up. How did you go about doing that?
So really just working with Robert and Nicola on a couple of projects, one of our projects on the meetup and mm-hmm. then also a client facing project. So really just observing on that for the time being, because I'm learning, but getting all of that organized in, I think we used VS Code. So mm-hmm. Microsoft Virtual
Studio.
Visual Studio.
Visual Studio Code. Yeah. I guess they're, so VS Code. I'm not very much of a Microsoft person, to be honest.
I'm not really either. So it's the only one that I've used. I find it a little bit buggy, but that's, and I've already tweeted about it. And I'm finding mm-hmm. that I'm very opinionated as a coder, which is kind of interesting.
That's
because
really
I'm a lot more middle of the road, diplomatic when it comes to work environment.
Nice. Yeah. So I guess like Visual Studio is more like the IDE that you'd use for a lot of the Microsoft suite products, whereas VS Code is much more of the light editor. Something comparable to like Sublime Text or Atom or something along that.
Fair enough.
So you're saying you did some different things, also a lot of node-based stuff.
Yeah.
So what did that entail?
Just really working in the editor and making tests, getting tests from a failing state to a passing state, mm-hmm. and just working through that. Also working on some logic problems and different operators and things like that. Mm-hmm. And just, again, just kind of getting familiar with everything. One thing that's really awesome is I am exploring the deep end and also getting the context of things. And I really appreciate that. So the people I'm working with have years and years of experience. And it's really great to be, I don't know how you would describe it, almost apprenticing under them, which I think is one of the best ways to learn.
I think so, too. And that's an interesting thing. I often wonder different workplaces, what it's like. From my experience, I found a little bit of both. You know, it depends. I wonder what it is that it depends on. Does it depend on the developer there or the management? Is there something different from those two things that combine to form the company culture or what? Where you see some places where you have very much siloed developers working alone, they may or may as well not even be in the same room, mm-hmm. yet they are. As opposed to, on the other hand, some places take it to the other extreme where you're always paired up, you're always in a group, and you know, so then you're going to have a lot of collaboration, whether there's the mentorship, apprenticeship type style or not, I'm not sure, but depends on the situation. So I've seen and heard of a few different things. One, Pivotal, mm-hmm. I think their style from across most of their products, I'm not sure about all, so they've got obviously Tracker, project management tool, and some other things, but the Cloud Foundry project, which we were working on at ActiveState, some of the people actually started pairing up with others from the Cloud Foundry Foundation, mm-hmm. and that would be remote pairing, but you'd have your pair would actually be three. So there's three people always programming together, and I don't know, I've heard some good things about it, but I've also seen some people somewhat seem to burn out from it, but their slogan for that is, you know, you come into work, you're coding 8 hours a day, and then you're done. you're with your parent and you're done. There's no overtime or anything like that because you're super productive. And I think that's kind of neat. And then other places, Hash Rocket, one I can think of, that is like a, I guess like a boutique app development shop. And I think they do mostly Ruby on Rails, but I'm pretty sure they could do other things as well if they wanted. And they do 100% pairing all the time, where they're, I think they only have like 10 or 12 developers, and I think they have two offices in each of their offices, and they're always changing pairs so that there's no sort of, so that they really keep a consistency among the way they do things, but at the same time, if somebody's learning something else and that's kind of cool, they get a chance to share it with the rest of them. It seemed like a really cool place. I had a preliminary interview with them once until they found out I was Canadian, and then they're like, "Now we don't have a sponsor." And I was like, "Oh yeah, that's a thing."
That's unfortunate.
Yeah, and then other places where you get your work and you do your work, and you may or may well be all by yourself. So I wonder what makes those that the difference in those cultures. What do you think?
Well, I think it's good to feel like you're part of a team, definitely. And I mean, each person's going to see how to break down a problem a little bit differently, which I think is a good thing. You want to have, I think, at one point, a sort of a unified direction of which way you're going, but it's always helpful to have somebody point out a different way of doing things. So it's like debate. You can either be, I remember watching something on Saturday Night Live, how they were talking about the skit was about the bubble, and it was pretty awesome because it was in, I guess, a reflection on the current winner of the election in the States. And it was a bubble community that for $1.9 million, you could buy a condo in Brooklyn. And they had all these things like, you can talk about many, many things, and you've got a conversation with people. They're like, yeah, exactly. Yeah, I agree. Totally. Absolutely. And it just kind of leads to a state where, I don't know, there's nothing really interesting being talked about, and you're not really.
Challenged.
Yeah, you're not really challenged. You're not challenging how things are and how they should be and making things better. You're just agreeing on everything. And that's great, but I think to
Is it
have,
great? Is that
well,
what your point is there? That's
no.
great.
I mean, it's nice for a while, but at the same time, I think it's also really important to challenge and ask why. Because there's always a better way to do things. There's always a better way to be more efficient. And you don't need to do that in a caustic or a reactive way, just in a, in a respectful, debate-based way. So I think having differing viewpoints on a team is definitely going to make you stronger as a team versus a bunch of individuals that think exactly the same way, working to exactly the same point.
Yeah, there was, I think a common theme was mentioned in a book from about 10 years or so ago, Wikinomics. I'm not sure if you read that, but one of the points made there was you could take a team of like four or five or six or 10, whatever, any kind of arbitrary number of the world's leading experts in a particular subject and kind of put them in a silo to work on a on an experiment in secret, not allowed to share any of the details with anyone outside in the outside world. And traditionally this was the way to solve problems, like let's throw some money, let's get some people, put them in a box because they're the leading experts in the world, and let's have them solve the problem. Whereas on the other hand, you could open this problem up to the world, and this was kind of talking about open source, the open collaboration model, Wikinomics, kind of the Wikipedia approach to economics. And it brought some other interesting examples of, I think one of the examples in this particular case was a mining company in Canada somewhere that had spent millions and millions of dollars looking for, I believe it was actually gold deposits somewhere, and they're the leading geologists were looking and weren't able to find it, and they opened it up. Anybody online could kind of use the result set and come up with interesting sort of projections to say here's where the stuff would be. And it was interesting the people that came up with some of the winning answers, and the winning answers were kind of chosen based on they found gold. So,
Okay.
and so they ended up getting some money from that, as well as the company obviously found gold. So that was a big win for them. And it was really interesting to see, like it was maybe some, elementary school. I don't remember what the actual people were, but it was something like an elementary school student in Australia and like a retired chemist in Germany or something along those lines. Like, but people who are actually generally interested in the problem set and kind of gravitated toward that naturally. Which I think is also quite interesting because around the same time, maybe a little bit after, Simon Sinek was talking about like start with why and blah, blah, blah. But one of the example, an interesting thing that he talked about as well was I think the Wright brothers and how they were really looking for, this interesting challenge. Can we do this? More than probably anything else, they just really wanted to do it and they were passionate about it. And there was another person, and I can't think of his name, and I maybe somebody can, but it's actually not important because of the next part of this, is that he lived in New York and he had, like, I think he was commissioned to figure out flight, and he was an engineer and really, you know, intelligent. And and as soon as he found out that the Wright brothers were able to fly, he was like, okay, I'm going to move on to something else. Whereas I think Simon continued with the story, you know, had that gone the other way around, the Wright brothers probably wouldn't have given up. They probably would have kept going because they had that passion. And sure, somebody else figured out how to fly, but they wanted to do it as well. Mm-hmm. You know, and so it was because of that passion, that drive to just do that thing. And I think that that's an interesting thing. So sometimes when it comes to opening up collaboration, maybe you're allowing somebody who cares about a particular problem to come in and help you solve it or see a different way to solve it. Mm-hmm. Is that what you were kind of getting at?
Yeah, exactly. You never know where your best answer is going to come from. You can have people that have been looking at a particular problem set for a really long time. And I find it's often fresh eyes give a different perspective. You're able to see things that, it's like the forest for the trees argument, which I actually don't really know how that goes. But you either see trees or the forest anyway. Yeah. So basically, when you're exposed to a problem for the first time, I think you have the unique opportunity to be able to assimilate it without any bias. And I think that's maybe what the fresh eyes perspective really gives as a benefit. So yeah, I think if you're really interested and bought into finding an answer, being open to how the problem's solved is important. And again, it comes down to like brainstorming. If you've got a group of people trying to solve a problem, like sure, some really outlandish ideas will come up, but you also have some really good ones that you might not have had if it was the same team working towards exactly the same goals with exactly the same background and variables.
I'd like to see some studies on that sort of thing and mm-hmm. some metrics.
Yeah.
It might be pretty interesting. I do tend to think that something like Wikipedia, where anybody's able to edit it, ends up giving us some of the best information we could have. And I think that's a really powerful thing.
Absolutely.
So what else did you get up to this week?
A couple of meetups. I went out to Hacker Nest on Monday, which was mm-hmm. awesome.
Nice. Yeah, that was at CodeCore. I thought mm-hmm. it was a really good way to kind of finish up the year. Really nice space. They seemed to be doing really well. And yeah, we had a good turnout, I thought, as well.
Yeah, especially for December, because, you know, it's the season of holiday parties. So, yeah, there was a lot of people that showed up.
It was November, by the way.
November, right. Well, almost December. Still the holiday party season. Mm-hmm.
But it was still November, I would say. It was the last, it was the end of November.
Fine. you're right.
I know I am. Well, I actually pretty happy with it. It was nice. I haven't been to CodeCore in a long time, and I forgot how much I miss it. Cool. Yeah. What else?
Really just focusing on the coding. I've actually, I'm keeping a blog on that. I'll start posting that soon. I want to get to 3 entries and then I'll post it. For some reason, I think you need to do something 3 times in order to make it a habit or a pattern or establish that. So
interesting. I think you need to forget something 3 times before you remember it when it comes to concepts in learning languages, natural languages.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Huh.
Makes sense. To think that.
All right. Well, so as far as the coding stuff, so some of the protocols that I have been learning and I focused on this week. So Bash, GitHub, JavaScript, Node.js. I've been working in Markdown for the podcast for quite some time. Mm-hmm. I have some HTML experience, so just expanding on that. And then really looking at the event sourcing ways of doing things.
Mm-hmm. So you said Bash, you said Node, mm-hmm. Markdown, maybe something else.
GitHub,
okay.
And Git.
And Git, I would imagine, as well.
Yep.
So let me ask you maybe a couple of questions.
Sure.
I remember when I was first starting out, it wasn't necessarily clear to me. Can you tell me what, if anything, is the difference between Git and GitHub?
Good question. From what I gather, Git is the way that you access GitHub through terminal or something else. So you've got like Git clone and Git other things. And then for GitHub, for me, that's like the online repository. So that's a distinction that I see. But again, this is
That's pretty good. Like that's probably how a lot of people see it, okay. As if like GitHub is the web-based client and then you're accessing it through your command line interface, which is Git. Whereas they're actually two completely separate things. GitHub does not need to exist at all. And Git actually existed before GitHub. And there are other options to GitHub. All GitHub is, you can imagine this. files. Mm-hmm. So you might imagine Git to be like files. And files existed far before cloud sharing of documents, before Dropbox, for example. Yep. Dropbox and files are completely independent concepts from each other.
Right? Absolutely.
So same kind of thing with GitHub. It just happens to have Git in the name, and people happen to use Git repositories with GitHub a lot. Mm-hmm. But that's an interesting kind of idea, is that with Git, we have distributed source. So you have a copy, I have a copy. Which one's the source of truth? We don't necessarily have a source of truth. You know, we have a master branch, and maybe that's the source of truth, or maybe we look at the history and that's the source of truth, and we can check out any sort of commit or branch, and that's really interesting. So everybody's copy may or may not be equal. We can update based on other people's additions and so on and so forth. And so it's really powerful. But then when we look at GitHub, then you might say like, oh, what's there is now the source of truth. So now we're taking this distributed source and we're kind of putting it in a single area as well. So I think that's an interesting thing about the two. But some alternatives to GitHub, one that operates very similarly.
That's Bitbucket, right?
Bitbucket, yeah. Something that I don't know if anybody else has noticed this, and I haven't played around with it enough to know exactly what the ins and outs are, but I have noticed that Bitbucket's markdown varies somewhat from GitHub's. And I'm not sure if that's like because GitHub's doesn't follow a standard and Bitbucket's does, or vice versa, or just bugs or whatever. Mm-hmm. But I have noticed that, you know, sometimes not getting something to look right in a README on Bitbucket has been really frustrating. Have you noticed any of that?
I haven't gotten too deeply into those, but I do, again, I've been accessing some files from Bitbucket and also from GitHub. So I imagine as I play around with it more, I'll develop some opinions.
Very cool. Nice. All right. So yeah, I also went out to Hacker Nest last week, obviously. Mm-hmm. Saw you there. And I also went to the DDD CQRS ES Practitioners Meetup.
Yes.
And saw you there as well.
Yep.
And followed that up with the Ruby Lightning Talks, Vang Ruby Meetup, which is also a really excellent meetup, I think. And the Lightning Talks especially are great. And this year was awesome. It was over at Unbounce. And that was kind of neat because there'd always been like a really strong association, I think, with Brewhouse mm-hmm. and the Vang Ruby community. And I think that's, I'm not sure exactly what's happening, but it seems like Brewhouse is more focused on one of their products, GoodBits. And so a few people, I think Alex had mentioned when he was on the show, mm-hmm. himself included, a few people from Brewhouse have now gone to Unbounce so that the remaining people, this seems kind of interesting, like, oh, we want to get rid of all of our people so we can focus on a product. It seems kind of interesting. Anyway, I've gone over there. So I guess it makes sense that now the Vang Ruby community is it now associated more toward another company, Unbounce, or does it now become more of just a community thing in general? I think this has always been, as long as I've been in Vancouver and attending meetups, mm-hmm. this was the first meetup that I went to. It wasn't a Lightning Talk, it was Vang Ruby. And it was great. It embodied, I think, everything that you'd hope a meetup would. Mm-hmm. Very welcoming group of people. I was super nervous, to be honest, to go to my first coding meetup because, you know, I'd had a diploma in CompSci. You know, I'd spent a couple of years working on programming myself. I wasn't very comfortable with Ruby at the time, but I was still really like, am I good enough? I really didn't feel good enough to expose myself like that. Mm-hmm. And the people were great. It was really awesome. I sat beside somebody who was, I think, a PhD physicist that then got into coding and started a company and had spent years and years writing Ruby and used Emacs and was just an amazing person on my one side. And then on the other side was Caleb, I believe.
Okay.
That was really interesting. And then Gabe was right in front of me. So those are names you may or may not know, but you would know if you went to the Ruby meetup probably. I think they still go. I don't know.
Yeah, that's the thing with meetups. I found meetups to be very welcoming, and I think they're a great idea. Again, it sort of fosters that community environment. Otherwise, you're kind of on your own and figuring things out on your own. And I mean, that can be good. Sometimes you need to focus, but sometimes it's nice to have a group to bounce ideas off of.
Goes back to the original idea, I think, of is it better to be siloed or work in a group?
And yeah.
Yeah, I find for me, at least, if we look at, like, say, the traditional school model, mm-hmm. there's a lot of interesting things that you can learn in a classroom. But if you're only sitting in the class listening to your teacher and then that's it, you're probably going to, well, I don't know if this is a probability or not, but I feel that you're missing out on the whole, you know, go out during recess or lunchtime or after school and and talk with the rest of your classmates, even if it's about things that you didn't talk about in school, about other things you saw on television, you know, my mom said blah, 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 or whatever, and you're learning so much. I would actually kind of wonder, like, where are you learning more? If we were to somehow say, like, the value of this in-classroom learning versus the value of this out-classroom learning, and particularly if you took some students, we're never going to be able to do this as an experiment for somewhat obvious reasons, but if you took a number of students and kept them out of school on purpose, giving them no other sort of form of education, and just brought them to schools during recess and lunch and after school to hang out with those kids, would they develop at different rates?
It's a really good perspective. I don't know. I mean, if you look at it,
might not learn how to read or know mathematics or yeah, so.
Right. But assuming that that's being taken care of with like homeschooling.
But we actually assumed that it wasn't. We said no other education.
That's
kind of the point there.
Okay.
And then maybe you'd have the homeschooling ones as well.
Yeah. I think if you had the homeschooling component, I think that those people that just come to school just for the social aspect would probably be smarter and more well-adjusted and better prepared with the materials.
Well, don't we already see that kind of with people who don't even go to the school during lunch and recess? The homeschooling tends to be really good.
Maybe. Yeah, I don't know. It's an interesting social experiment for sure.
That's never going to happen. We're not going to be able to keep kids out of school.
Nope. Might be a little unethical, maybe.
Yeah. Anyway, so tell us about the week coming up. Are there any really cool meetups or any cool things that you're hoping to go to or planning to go to?
Yeah, there's a lot of awesome stuff happening this week. So starting off the week, we've got Confu, which is a web developer conference. That's over.
And you're going to that?
Well, I don't know. We'll have to talk about that after, but I may either come out to the social events or stop in and check out one of the days. We'll see. Mm-hmm. That's at the Sheraton, and it goes from Monday to Wednesday. And it looks like a really awesome event. So there's a lot of talks I'd love to go see if I have the opportunity to.
Yeah, it looked really cool. James actually reached out to us and said he might have a couple of extra tickets available, and then said, oh, no, they're gone. Might have one, though. I'll get back to you. I'm guessing that by now he hasn't gotten back. We're not getting a ticket, but it does look really awesome. So it's like $1,000 a ticket, and it's 3 days that you'd have to take off work to go to. So there is that, right? But yeah, it looks like some really cool talks. I was really looking forward to some of the stuff. Like, it looked like there were a lot of, you know, productivity command line stuff with Ruby. And there was some cool infrastructure stuff. There's some great microservices stuff. And so it looked like, you know, kind of all across the board, there were some talks on security. And, you know, if you're interested more on, you know, in the JVM, I think there were some Java sort of based ones. I really liked a lot of the ones that I identified with because of the Ruby, because of the microservices.
Yep.
And then on the other hand, I think there was a lot in like Node, and it seemed pretty cool. Awesome. But I don't think I'm going to be going. So I guess my question is, are there any that you're going to go to that you're really excited about, or you're really excited about and wish you could go to, but you're not?
Well, that's
just the very absolute highlights.
Fair enough. There's another one that looks really interesting, the PyLadies Code Jam. That's over at Mobify. So I went out to the last meetup that they had. I forget exactly where it was. Radical Entertainment, I think. It was over near the train station on Terminal. So great space and really awesome group. I found them very welcoming. There was a GitHub tutorial, the intermediate tutorial, and it, you know, they had pizza and drinks and a really well-structured presentation and lots of time to practice. So I thought it was a really great meetup, and I would definitely love to go to that. But again, it comes down to timing. So Tuesday, there's a bunch of stuff happening that, again, I really want to go to. One of the things that I went to a couple of months ago was the Van F Up Nights. So that's over at Gilt & Co., which is One Alexander, from 6 to 8:30. And what it is a bunch of people that, usually it's four speakers, and they talk about a time in their life that things didn't go as expected. And it's like a learning experience. And really, it's kind of humanizing people. And, you know, nobody's 100% successful 100% of the time. So it's what you do with, I guess, your failures and how you recover from that and how that makes you grow as a person, which I think is a really awesome lesson. So that's actually where I met Hussein, who we had on the program a few weeks back, and he told us about one of his stories. And I thought that was a really enlightening story, and, you know, I really respected him as a person a lot after hearing that. So they have another one coming up this Tuesday, and I'd very much like to go to that. There's also a couple of other social events that I should be going to. There's the product managers group, and there's the PMI Canadian West Coast chapter. They're not coding centric, but a good ones to go to. And then there's Polyglot also on Tuesday. So Tuesday's pretty packed. Everything starts at 6. So how do you clone yourself and go to everything? I don't think you can, but.
No, I guess you can't.
No. Then, of course, we've got the DDD CQRS ES practitioners meetup on Thursday, which I'll go to.
So that's, of the highlights, that's the one. You always mention that every time.
I do.
And I just have to point this out. So you're affiliated with it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's, are you only mentioning it because of that?
No, I mention it because I like the way that we do things.
So it's actually an amazing meetup.
It
and
is.
You, even if you weren't affiliated with it, you'd probably talk about it every week because you would go to it anyway.
I probably would.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
Really great meetup. You gotta check it out. That's the DDD, CQRS, and yes. ES practitioners meetup.
Yes.
Nice.
I get the sense you might be making fun of me a little bit, Drew.
I don't know. It is a great meetup, and I did actually go to it this time. And
it's great to see you at that.
Yeah, I actually met you at the DDD, CQRS, ES practitioners meetup for the first time.
Right.
So when I was a little closer, I was going to it all the time, mm-hmm. like every time, but now I'm over on Granville Island, and for some reason, like, just crossing that bridge means, like, everything is a million miles away, and I can't ever go to anything,
mm-hmm.
which I think is kind of unfortunate, but, I mean, I kind of don't like it. I hate being on Granville Island, to be honest. I really, really hate it. I hate that I have to cross a bridge, and I like Granville Island. I think it's a cool place. I would love to go there sometimes, like, once every couple of years. I have a bagel. It's amazing. I think it's a really cool place to go to every day, and I'm really happy that I do go there every day.
Mm-hmm.
But I wouldn't want to live across a bridge right now. You know, I like to walk everywhere, and being able to just step out for like a lunch and learn, or, you know, go meetup hopping is so great. And that's one of the best things about living downtown, I think, mm-hmm. is that you should be able to. But when you live downtown and you have to travel outside of downtown to work, I think that's worse than, it's definitely hands down worse than choosing to live outside of downtown and traveling downtown to work, in my opinion. What do you think?
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense because there's definitely more community here. So I would agree with you there for sure. If you've got a meetup, like say a lunch and learn or something that's, you know, a couple of buildings over or a couple of blocks over.
So convenient.
Why would you
just run out and go to this lunch and learn?
Yeah.
And it's cool. And there are a lot of really cool lunch and learns that happen. I haven't been to one for a while now. And
because
I think I know why.
That big commute.
Although, having said that, I did see a meetup that I wasn't interested in at all at the time. But there was a project managers meetup or something like that, a lunch and learn.
Mm-hmm.
On Granville Island one time in the summer. And
okay.
I was like, wow, it happens over here. So, and then having said that, there are a number of tech offices around the area.
Mm-hmm.
If I really cared that much, I could schedule some myself.
That's true.
Yeah. And it is actually, in all fairness, Granville Island's pretty awesome.
It is pretty awesome.
Yeah.
It's great
and
space.
It's not really that far.
It's not like walking to Burnaby.
Yeah. Do you have something against Burnaby or something?
No, not at all.
No, I'm just kidding.
I like Burnaby.
You're right. It's not like it's that far of a walk. It's a little bit of a bridge.
Yes.
It's easy to take an Evo or grab a Mobi.
Mm-hmm.
Have you used those? What do you think about these? So car sharing, bike sharing, all this stuff in Vancouver, but no Uber.
I think it's a travesty that there's no Uber here because I think that's one of the best ways to get around traveling. I always use Uber.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the reasons I use Uber is because I think it provides a competitive landscape. So
mm-hmm.
finding a cab in Vancouver can be near impossible. So if you add another service, I think all of a sudden both of those services are going to be pretty good. At least you'd hope. So,
I hate cabs in Vancouver. Yeah, that's
yeah.
something I would rather walk, you know, than take a cab. And I have lived in countries and cities where that's just not the case. Taxis are awesome.
Yep.
You know, I take them all the time. I lived in Seoul, in South Korea, and taxis were just a part of daily life. You know, they weren't, it didn't cost you $50 to get into a taxi for one. And then for another, there were a lot of taxis. They
yeah.
also had a really good transit system in general.
Okay. See, it's nice when
a
city
system
has that.
As well. Yeah, a lot of things were really nice. So, and really great internet. You know, I can't believe that. Like I actually had, you know, 10 years ago, I had 100 Mbps for $25 a month. Now I would have, you know, multiple Gbps. So way better for the same price, by the way. Sure, their country's smaller. I don't really feel that I get a lot of advantage of living in Canada with it being so big.
That's true. Very true.
But I do sometimes feel like our government makes a lot of choices for us that I would rather not have them make. And I kind of wonder why. So let's look at something like Netflix. Do you have a Netflix account or do you watch Netflix? And you get Canadian Netflix, but not American Netflix.
Right.
Why?
Good question. Right? It's all the regulatory stuff.
And regulatory stuff where? Mm-hmm. That our government puts in place to protect whom?
Right. Is it protecting Canadian content? And how I think it does that?
I think it's actually protecting the large corporations that are screwing us over, like Shaw. I hate Shaw with a passion, really. And like all of the internet and telecom providers in Canada, like, wow, I'm quite sure that if any of us actually cared enough to look at what and how they're doing things, we'd probably find that it's illegal. And they're probably in cahoots with our government.
You never know.
I think that might actually be a really fun project. And I did hear, so this was an interesting thing. There was somebody in that Hacker Nest, Tom, that I need to reach out to. And he said, you know, he has a group of all of these lawyers that meet regularly and they want to make an impact in tech. And they know law. And so they want to make, because they're lawyers, right?
Right.
And so they want to partner up with some people who can do tech stuff, like programmers. And I was like, hey, you know, we have some meetups that are all programmers that don't have any lawyers, and we'd love to build some stuff so we could probably do some things. And so one thing might be, you know, making law more accessible to the average person and blah, blah. But we could also look at that, like, you know, how is our, you know, politics and how are things decided for us? And is that really the right model these days?
I think that's a great idea. I mean, knowledge is power, right? Yeah. And if you don't like how something's run, why not look into how it's built and make something better? Like, if you look at other cable providers like Novus, I mean, they have far better service than some of the other big providers like, you know, Bell and TELUS and Shaw.
And an interesting thing with that, like Novus or Tech Savvy or whatever, they're it's not like they have their own networks. They're using Shaw's. And they're just, you know, getting it for much cheaper than we are and then selling it to us for cheaper than they are.
Yeah, it's a better service model for sure.
And I wonder if there's other things that we could be doing in other ways. So I do understand that, you know, internet and cable infrastructure probably costs a lot to put into place, especially when you have a sparse population and a lot of land. But at the same time, you know, who is that actually benefiting to have these large companies getting richer and richer, driving up the price of internet? We have people complaining, you know, groups organizing to say internet should be a human right in a developed country. And I personally don't disagree with that. You know, it's a resource that, like a public library, access to information, it's not something you should keep away from people. And certainly charging, like, I can't believe how much I pay for how horrible the service is. Like, I was paying about $200 a month for my internet and cable. And I just realized, like, wow, that just seems ridiculous. Of course, the Canadian dollar, I think, is just not worth much at all. So, you know, oh, make $100,000 a year. Not really. That's like 30,000 US or something, or in a real country. That's starting to be how I feel a lot of the time. And I don't really like it. So anyway, so now I'm only getting like 35 Mbps. And then so that's like $50 a month or something. But my actual bill is closer to 80.
Oh, that's annoying. All the surcharges and taxes and fees. And yeah, I think that's total garbage. And you look at the States and they're a much bigger population base,
right?
About the same land space. And
quite a bit smaller land space than Canada, actually.
Yeah, but the population that it serves on a whole, I think, is probably comparable. All right.
Sorry. Maybe you're right, but... Yeah, I mean, like, they do have, like, we have like 30 million in a space that's like 1.5 times the size of their land area, and they have like 300 million in a smaller space. So it's kind of hard to compare, I think. Like, and when we look at, so I was comparing to like South Korea, which is you know, almost double our population in about like 1/100 the size of a land area. So yeah, I mean, it makes more sense that they have, their infrastructure is well set up, their government's promoting education and development of their people and, you know, coding and technology, and so they have great internet for a low price.
Yeah, I think it's really important. The minute you start restricting access to information, that becomes a really slippery slope, and it's when you're essentially like our guest last week, Julia, with the Digital Economy Forum, I think what she's doing is great. She's promoting journalism in the digital space. And I think that that's so important, because if you don't get that balanced viewpoint, you're kind of being spoon-fed your information. And a lot of people just get too busy and they start consuming it that way and it becomes the norm. And I think that's so bad.
Yeah, I guess that also does kind of beg the question, like, balanced journalism, is there really a way to not be getting spoon-fed? Is there really a way to remove bias? And I think that's one of the things I really like about Wikipedia, as opposed to any other sort of source of truth, is that because anybody can edit it, you get more points of perspective and you get a broader range of truths that might be a little closer to, if you believe in a truth, to that than one person's perspective or even a smaller group of people's perspectives. It's kind of hard to say. Like, I think generally we agree that the quality of journalism has gone down somewhat with the web.
It definitely has.
Yeah. We had, I think, Jonathan Nardi from Betakit was on quite a while ago now. We'll maybe link the episode down below. But I remember him saying something about how, you know, before you try and report just as unbiased as possible, whereas now almost every piece is an opinion piece. And that's kind of expected. That's become kind of the norm. I don't know that that's better or worse or makes much of a difference. I would imagine that today's people are more conditioned or more used to the way information is flowing than they were before. You know, media is pretty powerful, but the amount that we have and the number of things going through, I think, take away a little bit from the impact of each piece of information traveling through media.
That's true. And I mean, we live in a state where we're really overloaded by information. It comes at us all the time, 24/7. And often it's the same story. So one of the things I like to do is look at, I'll pull up a channel or maybe a webpage from a different country and look at international news, which will be Canadian news, and get that perspective. And sometimes that helps because you get a more non-biased view that way, I find. And I found that in many different examples. If you look at, say, like Greek news or Spanish news or anything like that, it just gives you a much more balanced, non-Canadian centric point of view.
I find your use there of non-bias to be interesting.
Okay.
And I think that maybe tempering bias with other biases, it seems more appropriate in that case. Yeah, like different places are going to be focused on different things. And I think that's something that maybe it's a human trait or just any animal's trait or whatever. I think we tend to view the world from our perspectives.
Yeah.
I think there's not really much of a way around that. We're going to view everything around us from our own perspectives. And so like you said, I mean, if you're watching news from one country, it's going to have different biases from another country. But I don't think there's ever any unbiased information.
No, that's a very good point. I mean, I think with journalism, you know, like you said, everything nowadays has an op-ed spin to it, which isn't a bad thing. I mean, it's nice to have a voice about something. It's nice when people have strong opinions about something. But it's also nice to see the counterpiece to that. So again, it comes down to debate. Like, I took debate in high school and university, and I loved it because it gives you the ability to see an argument from different sides. And yes, you walk away having a viewpoint on something, but I really appreciate when somebody can structure an argument and I see it from a way that I hadn't seen it before, and that actually changes my mind. And I don't think that's a bad thing. I think it would be better if society as a whole was more open to learning different ways of thinking about different things.
Yeah, I think that makes a lot of sense. I think that one of the great things of having internet and connectivity with other people online is that we're able to share information much more freely. I think more than probably ever before, as we push forward with this sort of mass sharing of information, then mixes of language start to become interesting. I often wonder now, we've grown up in like America, Canada. I think particularly America is well known for having varied accents on different areas. So there's the standard American, which is unaccented American English, and then accented American. So you might have like someone from the Bronx versus, you know, maybe someone from
like Louisiana or Kentucky or California.
Oh, yeah. I think typically California is relatively unaccented, but maybe you'd have your surfer dudes.
Yeah, you'd be surprised.
Yeah. Well, I mean, you might hear an accent. What do you mean?
I don't know. I find it's more of a distinct accent.
Okay.
Yeah. Again, going back to Saturday Night Live, there was a really funny episode, a
Maybe
series of
that.
episodes, how they were talking about everything is so transportation based and there's so many different highways. So there was this soap opera style one, and they had this over the top soap opera, Spanish style soap opera, I think. And they were talking about the character would come on and he'd be, all dramatic. And I think, this happened and I'm going to have to take the 405 to here, and then I have to take the 101 to here. And it was just the way they talked about it. It was just absolute nonsense and it was hilarious. So,
Nice. Glad you shared that. Okay. So yeah, like I do often wonder, are we going to see like a flattening of accent now that we have this, information being shared, including audio, and maybe real-time voice chat? Are we going to start to see a flattening of accent? Are we going to start to see a blending of languages? Do we need to start to look at, what would that mean? Do we standardize on a language? Obviously, like an incredible amount of media and stuff currently is English, but an interesting thing, like a lot of that, could it change? I think this is an interesting question to look at. Before English, in the West at least, French was considered an international language.
Sure.
But I can see, if all of a sudden, if we look at the number of people we have online right now, do you know what the number is?
Like right now, worldwide?
Well, I mean, how many people have access to internet? Yeah.
I think it's roughly half of the world population, isn't it?
Really? I don't know. The last time I heard it was like less than about a fifth of the
Okay.
world's population, about one fifth, meaning like four fifths didn't have access. And so to put that into, terms,
It's like
something
one and a
like one and a
half
half billion,
billion, yeah.
right? Or roughly the population of China.
Okay.
So I think you could see that as China has some very developed cities, much more so than Vancouver in some areas and lesser developed cities. And if they really push their internet culture, and that could become a much bigger thing. Likewise with, a lot of other places, that doesn't necessarily mean that English is the end all be all. Although we do see that like a lot of the languages, and now with some of the capabilities coming up, are we going to see new and ha do we have yet computer languages written in other languages? Programming languages, I mean. So even like we'll see something like Ruby,
Right.
for example, which it was a Japanese developer, developed it in Japan. There's a lot of Japanese people that write Ruby, but it's not Japanese. It's still written in English
In English.
characters and,
Okay.
but are we going to see some point in time where we see the foreign language software, and are we going to have to learn it?
It makes sense. I mean, it stands to reason for sure. I don't know the coding standards and coding protocols for like why things are in English or why they're in a particular language, but I think if there was enough support from a community to create that, why wouldn't there be, right?
I'm pretty sure that it comes from a largely American and lesser British dominated internet.
Yeah, I'd like to find out more about this, and if there's somebody out there that
Well,
knows this
DARPAnet.
or is, expert in this area, I'd love to have them on the program and talk about it more.
Sure. Yeah, I think actually, like, probably most people who've done, read a computer science book would have a pretty good history, and most of our viewers probably do understand that, internet. So back in the day, people like Vint Cerf working on basically like internet protocols and commissioned by DARPA, so DARPAnet. You can look back at, some maybe historical movies, for example, like War Games or Jumping Jack Flash, and see some of the early days of the internet. But it was largely, I think, very much because of the way that the American school systems work. A lot of the time, you'd see either military or connection of research universities.
Right, makes sense.
And even Tim Berners-Lee, when he was studying, I think he was doing his master's through Oxford, but he was at CERN Research Center when he came up with the idea of linking files together and doing, because they were doing a lot of research, obviously in that case, at that time, at CERN, physics research, and there were universities in the States he'd be sharing papers with, and being able to link, so being able to publish a paper and have a reference from one to another paper was a really interesting idea. And so thus, HTML was born, and the ability to do these hyperlinks, and really the birth of the World Wide Web. But that WWW sort of thing, World Wide Web, or the HTML stuff, it still relied very much on there being an internet. So yeah, government facilities, and but particularly in the States. And if you look at a lot of people, so Tim Berners-Lee, by the way, was British as well, so that's a huge contribution.
Okay, so you've got British American influences. So of course that, yeah, that would lead to natural English being being the language there.
Yeah.
Huh. All right. Well, it's definitely a topic I'd love to explore a little bit more.
Yeah. I think it'd be quite neat. And I think there probably are some languages already that are written in other languages, because why wouldn't there be? I guess there's the difficulty of the text translation. And I think that was actually a huge thing. I don't know how much it was thought about, but started to put the standard numbers, the standard character set to be processed in on and through the internet. The way that you're able to read the characters, you know, it works very well with English, but not necessarily with every other language.
Right. Yeah, I mean, there's lots of different variations in alphabet and different letters, country to country and language to language. And the structure is quite different. If you look at something like Mandarin, I mean, it's very, very different from something like English or like another Latin-based language. I mean, if you look at something like Greek or Russian, again, very different, very different model. So.
All right. And I guess that's it for meetups around town.
All right.
And we're here with our special guest, Brent Vatney. Brent, thanks so much for being on the Vancouver Text podcast. I'm just kidding. I don't usually have like a radio voice or anything. Thanks. Thanks for joining us, man.
Yeah. Thanks for having me. Yeah. That was a really exaggerated voice.
It was. Right?
I was asking myself, what have I got myself into?
Yeah. Awesome intro though. Thanks.
So Brent, you're into some pretty interesting stuff, but let's go back to before all of this interesting stuff, with some other interesting stuff that you were into. And I think where I actually met you, I don't know if you were actually involved at the time, but I met you at Code Corp a long time ago.
Yeah.
And you were introduced to me as from Tam, who said, "This is my friend, Brent."
That sounds like something he would say.
It totally does,
yeah,
right?
I guess something like that.
So when I first met you, here's what I knew about you. There's Brent. He works remote. And I think at the time, as the story unfolded, I learned more and more about what that meant, and you were working for a company called Madriska.
Yes.
And I think you loved it, and you had a really great team.
Yeah.
So naturally, I was really surprised to see how the next few months, years of your life unfolded and where you are now. But why don't we talk about Madriska, what brought you to Madriska, and what you were doing before that?
Sure. Well, I met Tam when I was working at Partnerpedia, which has since been acquired by BMC Software.
Right.
So Tam was there, and we were working on a team together for just kind of like a one-off consulting project. And yeah, we got along really well. I had a good time working together and kind of stayed in touch when I left that company. And so I left Partnerpedia to join Madriska. While I was at Partnerpedia doing a bit of work on the weekends, doing consulting work with Madriska to kind of get a feel for what it was like working remotely, and for them similarly to get like a feel of what it was like to work with me. And sort of got to the point where I was working just too much between the two jobs that I kind of just went back to Brad Ettinger, who's the owner of Madriska, and said, you know, I kind of have to like make a decision now. Am I going to join you and work more with you, or am I going to stick with this company and kind of drop the extra work on the side? And so I decided to join that company, and they're based out of Chicago. Well, I say based out of Chicago, but really there's Brad is in Chicago, and the other employee, there's only one current, actually, no, there are two other employees now. The other one was at the time based in Connecticut. So they were just remote entirely, and their clients were all over the place from like Arkansas and San Francisco and whatever. So
but mostly in the States?
Yeah. They were all American. We did happen to have a couple of Canadian clients while I was there, but yeah, for the most part, well, prior to me working there, I believe all of the clients were American. So yeah, so I joined them and worked with them for about 3 years, and that was really awesome. I got to learn a lot from Brad. Brad is an incredibly intelligent guy who is passionate about things from the intricacies of law and the legal system to statistics to advanced type theory and cutting edge sort of academic programming languages. So there's a lot that could be learned from him.
Very cool. So you said, so you were working remotely, and it was very much a remote team, but you learned a lot from one of the people on the team. So how does that learning work on a remote team, and how would that be different?
I mean, I have to clarify. I did also learn a lot from Jordan. They just have very different kind of skill sets. I think Jordan is just like incredible at getting things done. He's one of the guys where it's like he'll be able to take a task given by a client, scope it out really well, handle all the communications, implement it in a really solid way that they're happy with. And like from that point of view, he's an incredible developer. And so
It's
I learned a
something
lot
I
from
think
him
that's
in that.
something that sounds like such an easy task, but
Yeah.
is like such an incredibly
It's
difficult thing,
really
isn't it?
hard. I had many occasions where I just kept having back and forths with clients because it was just hard to get on the same page about something, or it wasn't clear that there was something that they had understood was going to be done in this certain way, and then I'd understood it was going to be done in some other way. And that sort of miscommunication happens all the time. I think it happens whether you're working remotely or in person. Maybe you just have them looking over your shoulder more in person, and so they might catch it quicker, but that's not always the case, I
That
think.
actually is like in the most hopeful scenario, I think
Right.
almost.
Yeah. So sorry, what was the question that I just dodged there?
So about how working
Right.
remotely, and I think there's a lot of misconception, I think, about what that's like or how it should or would work. But you mentioned that you learned a lot from now you're also mentioning Jordan, but
Yeah.
Brad. While working on a remote team. So the question was really, how did that learning work? Like how does that work on the remote team versus in person, where we'd often imagine, in person you just sit beside each other and talk.
I think there's definitely a lot more time where you're just working on your own when you're working remotely, and I think there are benefits to that as well. I guess
Fewer
first it's
distractions,
worth,
maybe.
yeah, well, fewer distractions, and also you're maybe more willing to take time to figure something out on your own and not just be dependent on someone else giving you the answer all the time. So yeah, so essentially, like the way that it would work often is if I came across something that I didn't quite know what the best approach was, I might, if I was very uncertain about it and it was going to take a fair amount of time to implement, then maybe just leave a message. And I mean, I think we used HipChat for a while and then Slack and whatever, and just leave a message there, and usually Brad or Jordan would get back to me pretty quickly and just ask sort of, like, what do you recommend doing for this kind of database relationship, or how can I optimize this query, or like, how should I, whatever, all sorts of questions. And if it was something that I could just get something working right away, then I would maybe do that and then just show them the code and say, hey, what do you think about this? Should I do it differently? And that's just, like, I think pretty standard kind of approach to doing things remotely. Of course, code review, we didn't do as much as probably we could have. It becomes harder to justify on projects where clients are a bit more sensitive to the cost, which is, very common.
Right.
So
That's a really interesting point. Yeah. Should the customer be paying for me to learn something from somebody reviewing my code if it works?
yeah, I think learning is just one aspect of code review, right? There's
It really
also
is, yeah.
pretty much any time you do some code review, you catch some problem, whether it's like a subtle bug or maybe a design problem. There's all sorts of things that you can catch in that process that.
So would you say that when you first started working with Madriska, that you were, what sort of level were you at as a programmer? Partnerpedia, you said you were at before. Of all the people, I've met like a few people from Partnerpedia. It seems like they must have had a really great team of people at the time you were there, because everyone I've met seems really great. Is that true? And then, so it's five questions in one here. So yeah, what sort of level do you feel you were at joining Madriska? Was it kind of, you seem to suggest that you were learning a lot from Jordan and Brad, and it was a really small remote team. What sort of pressures were there? Do you have any advice for someone looking for a remote job? Maybe joining a team where you've got a couple of seniors and you might not feel that you're there yet.
Yeah.
And then what did you
So,
have to contribute to that?
okay. So when I was at Partnerpedia, I'd worked a couple of jobs before doing consulting with software development, and Partnerpedia was, like, outside of internships, the first one that was like salaried medical benefits and whatever. Like I'd done other things where, it was more of an informal kind of arrangement, even if it was like full time and whatever, sort of like contract. So that was different. Yeah, I found that, like, the way I like to organize sort of where I want to work is like, can I learn things from working with these people? And so, and is it like a place where I can get close to sort of optimizing the learning that I'm doing in the work? Because really, like, software development is a process of constantly improving your understanding and your skill set, and whether that's keeping up with like the latest JavaScript framework or whatever, or just better understanding simple design principles, or getting better at doing code review, or working on a team with other developers, or understanding client requirements. So it's just such a broad skill set, and I think that if you want to master, or you know, get close to some kind of mastery of the skill in whatever sort of specialization you want of it, you have to constantly be gearing yourself towards opportunities that maximize your chances of learning more and getting there. So I joined Partnerpedia because, quite frankly, it was like a company in Vancouver that was using Rails, and I was really into using Rails at that time, and was very, very interested in backend stuff, and it just seemed like a good place to go work. I didn't know a lot about the company, I didn't know a lot about the people working there, but I was very pleasantly surprised that there were a lot of really smart, friendly people there.
As an aside, what are your thoughts on Rails now?
It's great. I mean, there's nothing that you can use that you can create a project and like be so productive with on the back end. Just as far as I can tell, you know, there's nothing comparable on the Node side of things, where you have kind of like a very well understood architecture that has evolved and been tested in various situations over time. You have
with a number of go-to libraries.
Yeah,
kind of standardized.
Exactly. And the ORM layer, Active Record, I think, as much as a lot of people dislike it, I think for a lot of simple use cases, it's great. It's very helpful. And then when you want to break out of it, you can just write queries directly. And I just find that it's really productive. So maybe we'll see something like Phoenix displace that in the future, just by beating it in every category. right. But who knows what will happen there.
Yeah, I think that like ease of getting started is a big part of it. I feel like with Rails, I haven't looked at Phoenix that much yet, but it might actually be. It feels like it's probably, like you said, maybe the easiest to get up and running and be productive in right away and to actually do things. And I think for something like a web boutique, if you're doing multiple projects, maybe multiple projects on the go and doing somewhat similar sort of web development work continuously, I can't think of a better framework. Yeah. Likewise with like learning MVC, I think it's got some really good conventions that are really strongly enforced.
I think the main problem for Rails with me these days is just that the asset pipeline is really antiquated and doesn't work very well with the modern JavaScript ecosystem. So kind of just have to have like a separate Webpack build for your front end.
I guess like depending on what you're actually working on and what you're building, I find that for me, something that I don't particularly like about Rails is the tendency to just grab a library and have it do the work for you. Mm-hmm. And I kind of feel like it's somewhat relatable to, I need to select an element on a page. I'm going to pull in jQuery. Kind of a similar type of thing. I need to set some sort of permissions. I'm going to pull in can. Rather than think about maybe what problem am I solving? How do I want to solve this problem? Is there a kind of simple way? Now I'm pulling in a library and a DSL that everybody else has to know and be familiar with. And then if I want to change the way that works, then it becomes more of a much bigger task down the road than having built something from scratch.
Yeah, maybe that's the case. I think it's more dependent on the individual developer. Yeah. So you can make bad technology choices or bad design decisions in any language.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I'm not too concerned about that aspect of it.
Okay. Yeah, that sounds really cool. Okay, so coming back to what you were saying, and you really wanted to work with Rails, and so you were working with Partnerpedia and had a great group. And then I guess you got to a point, or you're just the type of person who's always working on something and always trying to improve yourself. And so at that time, led you to some consulting stuff?
Or? Yeah, I found that kind of the rate that I was learning at outside of Partnerpedia was much greater than within the company. And they had their projects were very limited in scope. It was kind of traditional Rails CRUD kind of stuff with maybe a little bit, a few more advanced things here and there. But overall, it was it wasn't particularly interesting, and I'd sort of figured out everything that I wanted to know from what they were doing after like 6 months of being there. And there were some of the people that weren't developers there that I had a really hard time working with because I didn't feel that they were doing a very good job or didn't understand the technology. And there were project managers who would come to you and say, the client wants this. I said, we can do it in this amount of time. Okay, let's do it. And then also, what is it? And you, so you, yeah, and in response to things like that, I just got a little bit frustrated. And they didn't really care as much about quality. They cared more about just like producing more stuff and earning, because this was a company that was had a services arm and a product arm. And so the services arm was essentially, that was what I was working on. It was sort of to fund the product arm, which at this point was just a sinkhole of resources and had zero revenue as far as I knew. So it was basically just churn out this work, get things done so that we can keep this product side alive. And so they weren't really too careful about making sure that the code quality was high or that the product, the end product was good. You know, there'd be like a mock-up done for a design for a site, and it would sort of make it through an approval with the client of, oh yeah, this looks like kind of what we want. And they'd say, okay, they approved it. Let's just implement this. And I'd say, well, there's clearly a lot of problems with this design. We should take it back. And maybe that wasn't my place in a large company to question those kind of decisions, but that's not something that I wanted to work on.
I think that's kind of interesting because I recently read a description of an engineer, and part of it was something to do with responsible with what you're producing. Mm-hmm. And I think that as an engineer, it definitely is, right? It ends up being our responsibility to say, you know what, maybe this isn't the right decision. And I think, Alex, you were mentioning that as well, like to push back up and to say, yeah, you know, is this really the right solution? Is this really what we want? If we're the ones building it and we're not going to take responsibility, mm-hmm, we're the last sort of chance that responsibility has to be taken. So I think it does.
Yeah.
It's a good place. And if you're not met with the right sort of management that you're bringing it back to, then that can be frustrating.
Yeah. So that combination of factors led to me leaving and joining Madriska, which was a really great decision. Worked with them for years, and you know, I could imagine in the future potentially working with them again if things work out that way.
Yeah.
Yeah, we built a bunch of things together. We had a good time doing it and learned a lot. So
with Madriska, were you also doing Rails as well as some JavaScript stuff, or
yeah,
what were you
doing? So it was really nice because there was pretty much a lot of flexibility. If you could pitch a client on saying you want to use this technology for it, or you want to maybe find some work that is building a mobile app or something like that, you know, you could use that opportunity to maybe in your spare time work on that skill. I mean, this is exactly what I did: work on that skill, learn more about it, and then get to the point where maybe you've built a few things on your own where you're ready to say, okay, let's try and find a client who wants us to do this. And sort of you do that, you do the work, learn a lot in the process, and kind of get to pick the areas that you're spending your time on.
So did you find while you were there, there were some particular technologies, maybe some JavaScript libraries or frameworks that you thought would be really interesting, and then you got a chance to play around with, and then thought later maybe they weren't as interesting as you would have hoped?
I think that's the general story for JavaScript frameworks over the last 10 years, right? And it's just because I think the requirements are constantly going up in terms of what you need to be able to do with JavaScript and do with the web browser. And so jQuery like was awesome at the time, where the applications were applications that were well suited for being built with jQuery. And then sort of they became more complicated and the single page app thing kind of came along. And so I used Backbone when that happened. It was sort of a way to build more app-like websites.
So what were some of the, I guess, the design principles or maybe patterns that Backbone used that made it different from maybe other frameworks?
So I think the thing about Backbone that was very useful is, so with jQuery, I found myself sort of moving towards having a pattern of saying like, okay, here's this screen, which I initialize with some parameters from the Rails side, which just takes some values from the database, throw them into like a script tag at the bottom, and initialize this like page, like let's say search page or something with this. And then that would then find some selectors on the page and do things with them, and maybe instantiate some other kind of object within there, which would be sort of like kind of like roll your own sort of component system type thing. And there's a lot of manual work in that. And so Backbone came along and kind of made a more formalized structure around, Backbone's a very small library and there's really not that much to it, but it did provide just enough structure on top of what was essentially nothing before to give you some patterns to work with and reduce the boilerplate that you needed for that. So that was good, sort of like the first semi-formalized system of components that I used in the browser. And after that, like, I guess I used that for a while and then looked at Angular, and Angular was really nice because it gave you data binding, two-way data binding, which seemed at the time to be really great, and it was. And I think most people ran into this, but once you started building larger applications, Angular didn't really have a lot to say about where to put your state or how to manage updating state throughout your application. By making two-way binding sort of the standard easiest thing to do, it made it very easy to build yourself into a corner where suddenly you add one more component to the page and your page is extremely slow because you have all of these watchers happening, and so the digest cycle ends up taking a long time. So that was kind of, that was one aspect of it. And then I also found that as the application grew, partially due to the state aspect, where there wasn't really a good formalized, as I was saying, like way to manage state or even a suggested way to do it. It was sort of just throw it on this thing called scope, which was like this basically state that's local to a component, kind of, but not really, because it's also inherited by components that are children of that component, unless you use certain scope types. And so what I'm alluding to here is that it's very hard to understand. It has a lot of concepts in it that my coworkers at Madriska would, after I wrote something and it seemed to me to be perfectly clear, they would look at it and go, I don't really understand what is happening here. And that was a very fair response, I think, because you get this initial experience with Angular, and I can't really speak for Angular 2, but this was when I was using Angular 1, where immediately, you do some data binding and you create like a search form that automatically filters as you type in. You're like, wow, this is awesome. This would have taken so much more work. Now imagine how much easier it'll be to build all this other stuff. And it is probably easier than using Backbone, and in many ways maybe better. But also it came with a lot of complexity in its own sort of very, very different set of terms. And, things like component became directive, which that's fine if the component, the idea of a component is widely understood and all you need to do is alias component to directive in your mind and you're like, oh, okay, got it. But now you have to understand, there's a very, I think Angular got a lot of flack for the term transclusion, which to this day, I don't think I fully understand the behavior of in Angular 1, which is pretty problematic. And overall, it just introduced this really huge set of concepts that had a lot of nuanced behavior and it was hard to understand. And so I described the Angular learning curve at that time as sort of initially you get really excited, you learn a lot, you have a great time with it, and then you run into a wall and then you feel like you can't do anything with it. And then you figure out that problem and then you figure, okay, good, I'm productive now. And then you run into another wall. And I feel like this just continues forever with Angular, where you never get to a point where maybe aside from the people who built it and manage it, they like fully understand all of the nuanced behavior. Whereas the next thing that I ended up using was React, and React was really amazing compared to sort of the learning curve of React was really amazing compared to Angular, because there's very small API surface area to React. There's a component definition. There are 7 or 8 lifecycle methods, which was something that, despite all of the features in Angular that existed, and there are many more in Angular than in React, it always felt like it was missing this idea of like, how do I manage the lifecycle of this thing? And you always had to manually do that within like a constructor for a directive. Whereas what I really wanted was hooks into like, okay, this component has mounted. Now I need to do something in response to that. Here's what happens when we re-render. Here's what happens when we're updating it. Here's what happens after it's updated. And things like that, which I think make it really easy to understand the idea of like what a component is, and then on top of that, the idea of scope that I was discussing before, where it's like, okay, it's component state, but not really, because it kind of gets inherited sometimes depending on what happens. And so, right. Whereas it's much more clear in React. You can have state on a component, and if you want to pass that into a child component, then you have to explicitly pass it down to that child component. And it's very clear where you have some data and you say, I'm going to give this data to this other component, and very straightforward, I think. And so there are really only two kinds of, I won't go into that. There's props and state. You can go to the React docs if you're listening to this and want to know more about it. So essentially this really simplified like the ideas of where to keep your state, and sort of, I think, the small API made it really easy for coworkers to look at my code and say, whether they had experience with React or not, still understand what was happening. And if they didn't have experience, they could probably learn it in an afternoon.
So something that I remember was that around that time when you started getting into React, this kicked off a whole different sort of, in my mind at least, mm-hmm. a whole new chapter in Brent's life, sure. which was now all of a sudden you were really excited. You want to spend as much time as you could working on React and not on work. And so now you were like, I want to spend a lot of time with this, and you started contributing maybe to some of the code.
That's somewhat the case. So at the time I was also like looking at Ember a bit, and still just mainly doing, like, I was doing some mobile projects, but mainly doing projects on the web. So a lot of that was still sort of like doing Angular stuff for legacy reasons. I was doing some React stuff for newer projects. But it wasn't until React Native was released that I really sort of switched over to spending a lot of my free time on doing React-related work. So that was maybe 8 months or a year after I got into
React. Right. And then, so when React Native was released, it was initially just for iOS?
Yes. Yeah. So it was released, I think, in March, almost 2 years ago.
Wow, yeah.
And initially only for iOS. And I was just really excited about it because I tried a lot of different approaches to making mobile apps. You know, I tried traditional native development. I tried various hybrid approaches. You know,
like Ionic.
Yeah.
Or I guess Ionic also makes use of Cordova.
Right, exactly. So Ionic is, I think of it kind of as like it's pretty much like a UI framework built on top of, essentially, well, it uses Cordova to access native APIs, but it's pretty much like a mobile UI framework, because it doesn't have to exist within the context of Cordova. I think they're kind of sort of transitioning the vision of Ionic to something that's oriented now towards progressive web apps as well. So progressive web apps being more like mobile-oriented websites, where you go to the site, and if you visit it frequently, you can kind of cache aspects of it and save it to your home screen and get push notifications and things like that, so that it looks and feels really fast and similar to an app, but with the limitations of a web browser. So anyways, yeah, that was something that I looked into a lot as well when I was using Angular, and I spent a good amount of time and tried to build several apps with it, and I ultimately just got really frustrated, because there were a lot of cases where it seemed like it should be really easy to do something, and I knew that it was really easy to do it on native, you know, if I was just writing Objective-C. But it really wasn't easy with Ionic.
Can you think of any?
Yeah, totally. The one that really annoyed me was, I wanted to just do a menu, like the traditional like Android like swipe in from the left side of the screen for a drawer, and it just didn't work. You couldn't get it to reliably work on different devices, or even just work very well on a single device. I don't know how much this has improved since then, but the gesture handling was just really frustrating and difficult. So that was, to me, like probably the most annoying issue. Another thing that was difficult was, in hindsight, something that would have been very easy for me to resolve, which was, I didn't like that a lot of the functionality that like came with Ionic just still didn't really feel native, even when they were using native APIs. So an example of that is like the Facebook login plugin that existed would kind of fast path you to it working by giving you like a web view that you would log in. So every time someone went to log in, in your app using Facebook, they would have to type in their username and password rather than it jumping to the Facebook app and jumping back, which was really frustrating. And I mean, in hindsight, you know, like I say, it's actually very easy to do that with Ionic if you know how to do it. But there wasn't really a lot of information available about how to do that at the time. And that's something that we talk about Exponent a bit later, but that's something that we are trying to make easier as well, and have run into, you know, similar kind of difficulties because it's just an innately difficult thing to do for people out of the box.
Nice. So initially, what was the big attraction to React Native? And it seems to be something that not only was it that new shiny thing at the time, it was something that really held your attention.
Yeah, so the experiences that I had with Ionic were, on one hand, empowering because it was great to be able to make these mobile apps so quickly, and on the other hand, very frustrating because I felt like my hands were tied in a lot of situations and I just couldn't do the things that I needed to do, like the side menu and whatnot, and, you know, performance issues, which I didn't discuss, but definitely ran into. So what was really great sounding about React Native was that you could kind of mix and match native functionality with essentially, like, you can write your own native code and mix in these native views inside of your app alongside other things that are entirely controlled by JavaScript. And so that seemed like a really powerful concept because you can use JavaScript as much as you want to and then not use it. I've since kind of changed my mind on that. Again, I can talk about that more with Exponent. But the other aspect of it was just that it was implemented, and, or rather, you know, based on React, which I had found to be just such a pleasant experience compared to using Angular. And so it was really hard for me to consider, like, using another thing that was based off of Angular. Just the developer experience, I felt, was a lot more solid with React. So yeah, it you know, solved that, like, big pain for me of not being able to do the things that I needed to do with PhoneGap and Ionic. And so that, yeah, I think that it was kind of that sense of empowerment that you get and that really hooks you on it, where you start using React Native and you realize you can use this thing that you're using on the web to now make these apps that you would have previously had to write in order to get this, like, same quality separately in Java and Objective-C. It'd take, you know, probably several times longer in order to do it. It just seemed like a really good solution to the problem that I had experienced in exploring the space previously. And so, yeah, it just really, really excited me.
Okay, very cool. And so it excited you enough to do it in your free time, I guess, also at work, and you started contributing.
Yeah. So I started contributing basically because I had a project at work that I was writing in Ionic, and that was right when React Native came out, and I thought, okay, I'm going to rewrite this in React Native. And given that it had just come out, it didn't support everything that I needed at the time, so I pretty much just looked into how I could implement everything that I needed to for that project, and where necessary, I would create some open source component and release it, or write a blog post about how I did something, or improve the documentation somewhere, or if some change needed to be made to React Native itself, and I'd do that, and just sort of using this, converting this project as a driver to do that. And I really enjoyed the experience, and working with people on the React Native team was awesome. They were all super excited about it, so they were eager to help
out.
Well,
I guess it was brand new at the time.
Yeah,
it was just kind of actually coming out. So Facebook had been using it.
Yeah,
had they been using it before releasing it?
Yeah, so they only release open source projects that they use in production. Right. So I believe at the time that they released it, they were using it on the Ads Manager app and the Groups app. Now they use it on Instagram and the Facebook app as well. A bunch of internal things, and I think maybe some other outward-facing apps. Well, they use it for, like, the F8 conference app as well, and the Oculus Connect conference app. And, so, yeah, all over the place.
Very cool. And so one question here is, you already had project partially completed or somewhat worked on in Angular, and then you thought, okay, I'm going to convert this over to React.
Yeah.
How did you get buy-in from the rest of the team, from the client?
So essentially the idea was, I did this on my spare time. So it was something where there was no cost to the client or to the company. It was sort of, I want to see how well this would do. And I was able to, yeah, recreate this thing. I mean, it was just a proof of concept for a client as well. So they weren't super concerned with, like, basically if there was a way that I could do it better, then and it cost them nothing, they would have been happy with that as well.
Very so, cool. So I've had enough of an attraction to React yet, or React Native was looking attractive enough mm-hmm. that you were interested enough to do this in your free time, mm-hmm. but also you had a really, I guess, maybe the right kind of project, a proof of concept yeah. that you could, it was maybe small enough, yeah. you could do it in your yeah. free time, and again, it wouldn't cost the client anything.
Yeah, and I was doing, prior to that, like a lot of stuff, like I was saying, exploring sort of the whole development space in my free time as well, because that was something that I just wanted to push my career in that direction. I just found it more, you know, as I spend more and more time on my phone, for better or for worse, I would like to be able to use this programming ability or whatever that I have to
superpower.
Be able to, yeah, I guess that's what, who called it a superpower? Was that like
I just did,
there,
I
Mark know. Cuban or something? I don't know. Bill Gates, I don't know, one of those guys. Yeah, I wanted to use it to like make stuff that I could just use on my phone. And it was just, yeah, phones are fun to play with. And I, over the years of working with Rails and building websites and whatnot, it had maybe lost a little bit of the appeal to me, where I'd sort of, I think, you know, going back to what I was saying before about trying to maximize learning, mm-hmm. It really like dropped off. The amount that I was learning by doing more and more web stuff was, yeah, the sort of marginal learning that I got from it was at a pretty low level compared to, yeah, in mobile, where, you know, there are so many new things to learn and new things coming out all the time. And I mean, that's certainly the case on the web as well, where, you know, I was just talking about Angular to React, but I don't think that even took that much effort, right? I think I learned React in probably took me a couple of days to fully grok the concept, because I was really absorbed in Angular at the time and kind of had a mental block to it. I would admit I was pretty resistant to the idea at first. And yeah, so I think still you can learn these different technologies, but I think as long as you stick with like the same kind of domain, you're still kind of limited to what you can do with it. So I spent a lot of time building websites, back-end stuff. I mean, there's so much more. There's an infinite amount of material and infinite amount of stuff that I could learn on the back end still. But I just wasn't as interested in it as building front end and yeah.
Do you have any idea why that is? Was it just that's the way it is, or?
Yeah, it's just the way it is. I just didn't care too much about it.
Nice. Yeah, I kind of feel like the same thing. I'm very interested in infrastructure and automation, cloud mm-hmm. infrastructure and microservices and Dockerizing things mm-hmm. and looking at different ways of handling that. And not as much in the front end, although with everyone, it seems like everyone's kind of really interested. And I think there's a lot of interesting things happening in the front end space, or at least have been over the last couple of years with Angular and with React yeah. Native, with the progressive web apps, I think, as
right.
well.
Yeah.
Just a lot of really cool and interesting things happening. And then on the other hand, it's something that you see it and you can visualize it. So that's really cool. Something that I kind of don't like about front end, it seems really finicky. Like, it's not just a matter of whether it works, it's that it works and it works well and it looks good and it looks good to many people. And it,
sure. I wouldn't say finicky then, I'd say like subjective.
Subjective.
Whereas I would say that infrastructure stuff is very finicky.
Okay, sure.
Like, I don't want to have a job where I need to be on call to wake up at 3 in the morning if a server goes down.
Yeah. So, that's actually something I don't like either. That's a really good point.
So, yeah, that was definitely a factor in the decision.
Yeah, I think that might actually be the point that I needed to hear. I'm all front end. So you're picking up React, kind of learning it, you're using it, React Native in client projects, you're mm-hmm. contributing. Did you set out to find a new job, or
no.
What kind of happened? And you were blogging as well?
Yeah, so I pretty much, within a few months actually of React Native being released, I switched over almost 100% of my work at Madriska to React Native client projects. There was a surprising amount of adoption early on that made it actually quite easy as someone who, you know, whether it was fair or not at the time, because I think everyone was sort of just figuring it out, you know, people kind of perceived me as knowing how to do things in React Native. Mm-hmm. And yeah, like I say, I think everyone was just figuring it out at the time, and we still are in lots of ways.
I think I was really lucky to get into Docker quite early and had a similar sort of experience with that.
There you go. Yeah, I think that's, if you manage to get into something early that gets a lot of attention, a little bit of experience can actually go a really long way. So I ended up working with a few really awesome teams. It was, really great experience. I really enjoyed working with a company called Idyne, which I was helping them build their app called Start, which is an app that helps you to manage your depression medication and sort of asks you questions every day or two and gives you results according to industry standards, sort of, it's called like a PHQ-9 or something along those lines, which asks you a certain set of questions and then tells you where you are sitting on the depression spectrum and kind of reminds you to take the medication. It's just sort of like a way to provide some feedback and help you understand whether your medication is working. And so that was a great experience because the team there was very passionate about it. There were a few guys that used to work at Google there, a guy that used to be an editor at Wired Magazine, and they just had a really great vision for it, and it was a fun team, and you know, really enjoyed that. And that kind of gave me a yearning to work on a product. You know, sitting with a team, working with them a lot in person. I previously just worked remotely for, you know, like I was saying before, all this client work, and going in there and spending a lot of time with them. So I guess I didn't mention that, but for a lot of this work that I was doing with React Native, I would travel to San Francisco and stay, hang out in the office for a while and work with them. And yeah, it was just really, it made me want to do some kind of product thing. And so I started, that was kind of in the back of my mind as I was doing more and more React Native work. And so I ultimately ended up doing some work also with Exponent and had an excellent experience working with them.
Can I cut you off there? What exactly is Exponent? Yeah. I know most people know, but what exactly?
Oh, do most people know? I don't know if most people know.
Well, that's why we... Let's make sure most people know.
Okay. So Exponent is a tool for making mobile apps. It is kind of, I think an easy way to think about it is like Rails for React Native. So React Native itself, you can kind of think of as like Sinatra. I'm assuming that the audience is familiar with Ruby and the ecosystem.
If not, they might be familiar
Python.
With Scala, so Scalatra.
Is that a thing?
Yeah.
I don't know. And Scalatra, and what's the other one, like Play or something like that, which is Rails-like?
Yeah.
And then Python, I guess there's Django and
Flask.
Flask is the other one? Okay.
Sinatra,
so Django being like Rails and Flask being like Sinatra. So basically what I mean by that is that React Native itself is kind of the core of it is very minimal. It provides you with this like set of components that are kind of like the primitives that you need to build your app. So you have like text and view and text input and image and kind of just like the bare bones stuff that needs to be there. On top of that, it gives you a really nice plugin API so that you're able to then add the features on that you need or install libraries that have these features. It provides the bridge, which is basically this layer that allows for communication between JavaScript and the native side.
So that's something actually I meant to ask was when we look at it, like PhoneGap, so I guess Cordova is the core that is kind of the translation between whatever your UI stuff and the actual native side. React doesn't use Cordova, so have they come up with their own, translation mechanism?
So I think the way to think of Cordova is like you can build apps using HTML and CSS and JavaScript. You could build native apps like that without using Cordova. You just simply use a web view and point it to a HTML file. A web view being like kind of think of it like an iframe, but like a native version of an iframe. And so what Cordova gives you on top of that is it gives you a way to access the native APIs. And so an example of that would be, for example, if you want to make the device vibrate, this isn't something that's just available in the JavaScript environment inside of the web view. You pretty much get like a bare bones setup of like what's available inside of your typical, well, depending on the web view, of course, because web views can be powered by Safari. You can have like a Chrome web view or Chromium, there's a variety of them out there. Unfortunately, there's not a lot of consensus around that, which does lead to a lot of problems. But these APIs that are exposed there are like the browser APIs. And so you don't have access to other device functionality that you would normally just have to write native code for. And so what Cordova does for you is it gives you a way to call. So it basically exposes like a Cordova object to the JavaScript runtime inside of the web view and lets you call into these native APIs, which is very similar, I guess, to what is happening with the web APIs, where a lot of these things, like if you want to, like WebRTC or some kind of video or whatever, really ultimately what's happening is that's implemented in C somewhere, and that there's some bridge between the C API and so that you're able to call it from JavaScript, right? There's some binding there that's happening. And so what Cordova does is it gives you some bindings between the platform APIs, device APIs, like vibration or open an image picker or send a push notification, show an alert, things like that. And it gives you a way to call them from JavaScript. So Cordova does that, but that's the extent to which the Cordova bridge is used. And we call this a bridge because they're kind of like two different territories where you have the JavaScript runtime and you have the native runtime. And this bridge allows you to send messages between the two. So it might say from the JavaScript side, you say, vibrate the phone for 1 second. And then on the native side, it will receive that message and then call into whatever API needs to be called to vibrate the phone for a second. And so Cordova gives you that on top of web views. So aside from that, in terms of actually rendering the content on the page, you're using HTML and CSS and the DOM, and so you're using divs and H1 and whatever, all the things that you're familiar with in the browser, which is great because you get 100% reuse potentially between your components in the browser. Knowledge reuse certainly is up there. But the downside is that I think everyone would acknowledge that the websites don't really feel like apps. Not to say that it's not possible for them to do that at some point in the future or for some subset of apps currently. But generally speaking, they just don't feel the same or look the same. And so what Ionic does for this is it provides you with like sort of like a UI framework. So it recreates a lot of the components that are included in the operating system if you were using the operating system's UI libraries. So in the case of iOS UIKit, right, you would have a slider component. This doesn't exist when you're rendering with the DOM. And so in the DOM, what you do instead is you create some kind of maybe like a div with another div where when you touch it and drag it, it has that same sort of appearance and does the same thing. And you customize it depending on whether it's iOS or Android. And so it looks very much similar. There are just small differences in how it behaves. And that ultimately leads to, unfortunately, I think as this all aggregates all these small differences and in some cases, large differences due to some limitations and performance characteristics of the browser, it just adds up to, I think, not quite feel right. So React Native, what it does is it has this bridge where you have JavaScript running inside of, not inside of a web browser, but instead, web browser, web view, instead of that, it runs just in a standalone JavaScript engine. And so in this case, it's JavaScript Core, which is actually what's used inside of Safari, but there's no DOM and there's no CSS and there's no layout and whatever. That's all removed. It's just you have JavaScript executing, and that's sort of where your React code lives. And then you have this bridge, which very similarly to with Cordova, if you want to make the device vibrate, you send this vibrate call over, and then the native side will interpret that and do something with it. But in addition to that, it also sends commands to do things like create views. So whereas all the rendering is managed in Cordova, you don't send anything in Cordova across the bridge related to like creating views on the screen somewhere, right? You create a div, that's just handled by the browser. Nothing goes across the bridge for that. With React Native, you create a view, that command is sent over to the native side. It says, create me a view with these properties. That view is then placed on the screen. And if it's a slider, then you use the actual slider that exists on that operating system in the UI toolkit that's given to you by the operating system.
So the big difference that would be that then you end up with native views.
Yes.
As well as being able to access the native API.
Exactly. Yeah. So yeah, that's pretty much the main thing there is you. I think it's a nice advantage because there are a lot of things that I think are overlooked as being maybe non-issues when you look at it.
Well, I think it goes back. Remember when I said front end is kind of finicky and you said, no, right. It's subjective.
Right.
I think kind of that, like, although in this case, maybe less subjective because would the native view, would it have a better look and feel on a given device than a web view? Mm-hmm. So sure, there's going to be some subjectivity to that, but I think we'd probably lean far more toward native being better.
Yeah, that's certainly my opinion. With the current state of the web browser, I think that is hard to argue with. Like I say, I don't think it's impossible for the web browser to catch up, although I wonder if native will just keep being a few steps ahead of the browser constantly. But there's so many cool things happening with the browser, so it's really hard to say. You know, when you get actual threading in the browser with web workers and can share, you know, share like mutable objects between these threads, so you can do work in one thread and pass it back, and then you have like better, so you can do something like rendering your entire React app inside of a worker and then keeping your UI thread entirely responsive at the same time. And you know, there's just so many things that can be done on the web platform as it becomes more extensible and more powerful. So you know, we'll see what happens there, but for the time being, I think, yeah.
So maybe tell us about how you got into developing.
Sure. Like, my distinct first memory of using a computer was I was typing basically into like a terminal, and I would just mash the keyboard and press enter, and it would tell me bad command or file name. And it just, like, I don't know why as a kid that was really exciting. I felt like, you know, you could say anything to the computer and the computer would just like,
bad command.
Yeah. And you're like, yeah. And I think I only played with it for a few minutes at a friend's house or something. And so you'd like swear at the computer and then it would tell you bad command. Oh, it knows it was bad command. No. And I don't, so pretty much like from the beginning, even the most like, as you know, simple, absurd, and basic form of entertainment on the computer that you could possibly imagine was extremely fascinating and interesting to me. So from there, I was very fortunate that my parents got a computer for me, and I use it all the time. I don't know what else to say about that.
That sounds
when
really
I was
awesome.
Very young.
So one last thing I have to add, there's so many things I'd like to talk to you about, Brent, and probably have to have you on again sometime. But one thing that I'm really excited about, and I'd imagine that you are, I'm kind of back-end developer peering over at front-end stuff and thinking, wow, there's a lot of cool stuff. One day I'm going to spend some time doing that, and that's probably going to be Sunday, but then I end up going out and, you know, going to visit my friend who's got a one-year-old baby, so they have a birthday party or whatever, getting sidetracked with other things. But eventually I think I will. And one thing I thought that this is just an amazing thing that's happening, we had Kenneth Auchenberg, he's the PM for the dev tools for Microsoft and for Edge. And then we had Brian Clark, he's the PM for dev tools for Mozilla's Firefox. And hopefully we'll have some other name from some other browsers sometime as well. But we were talking about some interesting things. And one of the really cool things, is the idea of pulling out the browser tools, the dev tools from the browser, and having sort of a standalone that you could plug into other things. And this seems like a really cool idea. And so Mozilla, they've been working on their dev tools, which were originally written in Zool, right? Some ghost from Demon, or I don't know what it was. But now it's all React, which is quite interesting, and it is open source. But there's this other project, debugger.html. And so January 23rd, the Vancouver Tech Meetup is having Brian Clark introduce the debugger tools. We're going to look at some of the bugs and some of the features in the project, and we're going to tackle them as well together as a community. So kind of getting people on board to do open source work and work together. And I thought that was cool. But it's React. And yeah, are you excited about the way that the tools are moving and the way that we're seeing things? So now if we have this tool that we can say, I want to debug Chrome, I want to debug Firefox, I want to debug Safari, I want to debug whatever, but now I have this unified set of tools. Is that a good thing or is it a bad thing? And does that even matter when it comes to something like React Native, where you've got maybe different debugging tools as well because it's not browser-based?
Yeah, I don't really know anything about this project. It sounds interesting to have a independent kind of toolkit that you can use and plug into anything. So with React currently, or React Native rather, you can actually use the React dev tools that are built into Chrome. So if you do debug in Chrome, it'll pop open a Chrome browser, and actually, rather than running the JavaScript inside of JavaScript Core on your phone, it'll run the JavaScript inside of Chrome and inside of a web worker. And so that it's actually kind of incredible that that works, because you have pretty much everything that happens. So I was saying, right, like creating views, that's a message across the bridge. So you're actually like running your app inside of a browser that isn't your device. Your device is just connected on a WebSocket to your browser and receiving messages about how the UI works. So someone will touch the screen, a message will go over to the web browser and say, someone touched the screen here. That'll re-render your app in a certain way, and the commands will be sent back to your app and update.
So you have your browser working as your server.
Yeah, which is kind of funny. Someone actually got this working on Heroku as well, so you could run your app from Heroku and, and basically have just a dumb client on your phone, which updates in response to Heroku sending the messages back. So I think that could be something interesting. I don't know what the value is of that beyond like removing something like that from Chrome. It seems to work okay in Chrome. I guess it's a little bit strange that you need to open Chrome in order to do it. Mm-hmm. So if there was something that was better for that, that would be cool. Although I guess you can use Electron currently. There are things like, there's a tool called React Native Debugger, I think it is, which is like an Electron app, which, as you know, uses Chromium. And so you can do the same thing. Essentially, Visual Studio Code plugs into it as well. So definitely the way that developer tools are moving now is pretty exciting stuff. I think like looking at Exponent, for example, I can't imagine, you know, if I'd seen this when I was first getting into mobile development, it would have blown my mind. You know, actually, maybe it wouldn't have blown my mind, because I would have expected it coming from the browser. I think if I had seen it be released right after I got into mobile development and experienced some of the pains of the existing tools, it would have blown my mind. But what it does is, like I was saying, it's Rails for React Native, but it just makes it like super easy to create a mobile project, use all sorts of native APIs in your project, have it work on iOS and Android, publish it so you can share it with your friends.
So for someone just getting into mobile development, would you recommend starting with Exponent?
I would absolutely recommend it, yeah.
What would be a good way to get started?
Go to getexponent.com and click on the documentation, and then go to installation.
Very cool. Well, Brent, if people want to reach out to you, what's a good way? Do you have Twitter, a blog?
Yeah, probably Twitter is a good way. I'm just not Brent on Twitter.
So are you Brent or are you not Brent?
Can't you do both?
Yes. All right. Well, thank you very much, Brent Batney, for being on the Vancouver Tech Podcast.
Thanks.
Thanks for listening to another episode of the Vancouver Tech Podcast.
Check out our website, vancouvertechpodcast.ca.
Rate and subscribe on iTunes. Much appreciated.
You can follow us on Twitter, VanTechPodcast.
Feel free to leave some comments below.
You can also hit us up on the YVR Dev, the Vancouver Tech, the Van Tech Slacks. I'm at James.
And I'm at Drew. Special thanks to Same Room for hooking us up with an integration that allows us to have a cross-team Slack channel, VanDevs.
Do you have a meetup that you want us to plug? Email us show@vancouvertechpodcast.ca.
Music by A Shell in the Pit from the game Parkitect. See you at one of the meetups
around town.